You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Blessed above all of creation, it was a rare and precious pearl. Conceived in faith and liberty, home of the brave, land of the free, it was the envy of the world. But this shining city on a hill has turned from the Creator's will and let evil take control. Now the reckless men who lead them want to strip away their freedom and to steal their very soul. Now it's smoke and mirrors, switch and bait, criticize and confiscate, and let the guilty walk away. In this once righteous, godly nation, in the halls of education, they forbid the child to pray. They say we need to spread the wealth. They pretend to guard the health of the feeble and the poor. While the hand they hold behind their back confuses and conceals the fact that the wolf is at the door. There's an unseen hand.
Well, today we have a terrific program on Connecting the Dots, and as usual, we've got an excellent, excellent guest on the program. Paul Dreesen is a really good friend and someone who has been in our on our radio programs before. He is a senior fellow with CFACT. He is also a senior fellow with the Heartland Institute and with the Heritage Foundation, as well as being an incredibly gifted writer. He's written several very good books on the subject of sustainable development, and we use that term very laughingly, but also the environmental movement and how they have literally ruined opportunity for developing countries to move into the 21st century with all of their really fascistic policies about the green environment that they see, the ultimate world that they see. Paul, welcome to the radio program. I always look forward to these conversations because you are one person that really stands out as being someone that doesn't put up with a lot of crap and has a tendency to be very, very outspoken about what's going on in the world. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Dan. I'm not sure those are compliments or certain people will take them as certainly criticism of my forthrightness because they don't like to hear what I say.
No, that's for sure. And I we're hoping that Caleb Rosser will be able to join us a little bit later in the discussion, but I'd love to have you tell our audience about the most recent experience you had when you were a speaker in, I guess it was a public forum, kind of a debate forum at George Washington University, and how the hecklers came out and wanted to make sure you didn't get a chance to say what you wanted to say.
Yeah, actually, it was Georgetown University.
Oh, I'm sorry, Georgetown.
Catholic University of sorts. Mm-hmm. Not sure how Catholic or religious it all is at all anymore, but there were about 60, 70 people in the room, but it turned out about 30 of them were hecklers, raising their voices, shouting us down, preventing us from speaking, just chanting various things. And I called a couple of them, said they were acting like fascists because the economic policies they espouse are fascist, where the government controls everything, everything a company is allowed to make and sell and do and say and think. And because of their gross intolerance for anybody else's viewpoints, I think they're essentially clueless and ignorant about all these issues, but they're very self-centered and self-righteous, arrogant, totally intolerant of anybody else's free speech rights. They kept saying they had a right to free speech while they're clamping down on anybody else's right to speak, bring out some facts, some points that might actually change their viewpoints about some of these topics of climate change and climate crisis, and also about the supposed renewable, sustainable alternatives to fossil fuels that they espouse, which are not at all free, renewable, eco-friendly, sustainable, or ethical. So they were finally escorted out by the police. And we had a good conference. It was not a debate because all five people that were speaking pretty much shared my viewpoints on things. But the fact is, Georgetown had just had a two-day conference from the other side. The Democrats had had two-day conferences with CNN and MSNBC. They'd ruled the day up on Capitol Hill. They pretty much ruled the mainstream and social media. They certainly ruled the college campuses, but they could not tolerate having a two-hour discussion of differing points of view on the Georgetown campus. So again, to me, this is rank fascism, and I worry about the future of the country if these kinds of people take it over.
Well, Paul, I noticed, too, that now the sustainable development crowd are coming out of the woodwork, and they're imposing their views on the UN and all these other groups. Of course, we know this is all orchestrated. The power centers are the ones that are creating this this situation, and they use their useful idiots that are more than happy to pick up on any of this anti-establishment stuff, because that, in fact, really does represent what people. I guess the average person in the world right now is seeing, I would call it the best term for it, I guess, is a dissolution of civil society. And we've got all these young people and all these people running around promoting fascism, promoting communism, promoting all the things that are antithetical to what our Constitution and what our limited government system was intended to do. And they have the forum because the controlled media, the we refer to as the lamestream media, is doing exactly their bidding and promoting the same principles, the same communist, fascist, whatever you want to call it, principles that that these folks are promoting. And so we've got a very lopsided discussion going on right now, and they not only are intolerant, they refuse to allow people like yourselves and like me to stand up and speak an opposing opinion. And that is the exact opposite of what our whole system of government was predicated on.
Right, and we're not only prevented from expressing different opinions. We're prevented from presenting facts about these things. They make all these assertions about a climate crisis, but they allow nothing to get in the way in terms of facts about temperatures and sea level rise and carbon versus carbon dioxide, tornadoes and hurricanes and so forth. I would say, though, that they're not exactly imposing their views on the UN or the World Bank or any of these international agencies and organizations. They are those agencies and organizations.
Right.
They are in cahoots with the UN and the UN IPCC. They are working together to push one narrative and shut down all other narratives, all other facts. They just they really believe their beliefs and ideologies and feelings are more important than actual discussion of the facts about hurricanes or tornadoes or anything along those lines. And then they're coming along and saying, based on this supposed climate crisis, man-made climate crisis, we are supposed to get rid of the fossil fuels that provide 80% of all the energy we use in the United States and worldwide, and replace it with what they claim are clean, free, renewable, sustainable, eco-friendly alternative energies. And the key point I would make and do whenever I have the opportunity and I'm not being shut down and shouted down is this: wind and sunshine may be free, clean, renewable, sustainable, and eco-friendly. However, the technologies, the lands, the raw materials that are required to harness this very dilute, widely dispersed, intermittent, unreliable, weather-dependent, and expensive energy so that we can use that energy to benefit humanity are absolutely not free, clean, renewable, sustainable, eco-friendly, or ethical. And in fact, those supposedly eco-friendly alternatives to fossil fuels cause far more environmental damage than any of the fossil fuel energy sources that those alternatives would supposedly replace. This is something else that the environmentalists absolutely do not want to talk about. It completely undermines their entire narrative. That the climate crisis is phony and the alternative energy replacements are phony.
No, you're right, Paul. And in every study that I've seen, the cost of renewable energy, their so-called clean green renewable energy, in fact, when you take away the tax subsidies and all the additional money that's pumped into this, they're actually less efficient and more expensive by a factor of about 9 to 1.
Yeah, and that's just the economics and the tax subsidies. I'm talking also about the environmental impacts, and we can go into that, whether it's biofuels or it's solar or it's wind energy, it's battery power. The environmental impacts are monumental. This the number of wind turbines and solar panels and batteries, these people have no clue what's involved. And then getting the raw materials out of the ground to manufacture all those facilities and pieces of equipment are monumental. The efficiencies of transferring energy from the sun and the wind into wind turbines and getting out electricity or putting it into batteries and getting electrical output are grossly below by orders of magnitude compared to nuclear or coal or gas or oil. This is, again, one more thing they don't want to talk about, and yet they are the ones that are going to be forced to live in the world they're creating. But so will millions and actually billions of other people that are going to be brought low by this fascist approach to our energy and economics.
Well, Paul, one of the things, and I would love to get into the actual explanation of why so many of these green energies are such an environmental problem. But one of the things that always comes out of these discussions about clean energy is the fact that the cleanest energy and probably the most sustainable energy that we have are two things that they absolutely want to get rid of. One is nuclear power, and the other is hydroelectric power.
Both of those are incredibly
reliable.
Gas, of course. I'm sorry.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Natural gas is right up there, too, and for that matter, really coal is, because they've tried to paint coal as being this dirty old technology, and in fact, the newer coal-fired generators in the United States are incredibly efficient and very clean.
Yeah, and that's why what they're trying to do now is paint the one emission from most of these modern coal-fired power plants as a dangerous pollutant, and that is carbon dioxide, the same gas that we exhale when we breathe, that all animals exhale when they breathe, that plants require for growing, and the more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the faster and better plants grow, whether they're crops or forests or grasslands or aquatic plant life. They all do better with more carbon dioxide. But these people, these basically morons and fascists to me, are insisting that the carbon dioxide that comes out of a natural gas or coal-fired power plant or any other source that uses fossil fuels is somehow a dangerous pollutant. So this is just one more of the lies they get away with. And yet, when you look at it, here they are. They're demanding that the United States eliminate its fossil fuel use and its carbon dioxide emissions within the next 10, 20 years. Look at what's gone on just in the last decade, roughly 8 years. The United States actually reduced its carbon dioxide emissions by 12%. Between 2000 and 2017, and a lot of that is because of the switch to natural gas. At the same time, India's emissions of carbon dioxide went up by 140%, and China's went up almost 200%. In other developing countries, you see the same thing. Plant fertilizing carbon dioxide emissions went way up, and that means even if we totally eliminate all U.S. fossil fuel use, it would do absolutely nothing to reduce global carbon dioxide emissions or atmospheric carbon dioxide concentrations. And I feel, of course, it doesn't matter for climate change because carbon dioxide is not causing climate change. Climate change is ruled by the sun above all and cosmic rays in the shape of our orbit around the sun and in among other planets, oceanic changes in the currents and so forth, hundreds of different powerful natural forces that completely overwhelm any influence carbon dioxide might have on the carbon on the fluctuations in Earth's climate.
Right, right. And incidentally, you mentioned how carbon dioxide makes plants thrive. When plants thrive, our oxygen levels go up as well because they produce the oxygen that we breathe. And so it is a mutually beneficial cycle for carbon dioxide to be plentiful. And in fact, in greenhouses, they increase the carbon dioxide in the air because the plants grow so much better and they use so much less water.
Right. The plants become more drought tolerant when the carbon dioxide levels go up, and that's simply because the little stomata in the leaves don't have to open as far in order to absorb the carbon dioxide they need. If they don't have to open so far, then the water inside the plant's leaves doesn't get out as easily, so they retain the water better and can make it through prolonged periods of lower rainfall and atmospheric moisture. So it's a win-win proposition all around. But the environmentalists, the climate alarmists, the UN, and the Democrats basically refuse to acknowledge any of this.
Yeah,
they're
they
scared
do.
To death, basically, to have a discussion or a debate because they would get pulverized, and that's why they're shutting us down. But in the process, they are imposing on us energy and economic policies that would destroy the United States and the planet, destroy our jobs and living standards, all in the name of preventing a crisis that doesn't exist and certainly has nothing to do with human fossil fuel use.
Well, and Paul, one of the things that we see repeatedly in all these demonstrations and all the things that are going on is an attack on capitalism. They want to destroy capitalism, and they want to promote socialism and, quite frankly, communism. So the communist countries and the socialist countries like communist China and India and, you know, Venezuela and a lot of countries, including the Russia, which, you know, really is still a communist country, whether they want to admit it or not, they get a free pass. And all the attacks are on capitalism and not on the countries that are actually doing the majority of the polluting. I think communist China, if I'm not wrong on this, and you tell me if I'm wrong on it, but they are the number one polluter now in the world by quite a large factor. And the United States, as you say, has been reducing its use of fossil fuels and also its carbon footprint.
Yeah, let's not confuse terms in terms of pollution, though. They want us to think carbon dioxide is pollution, which it is not. So yes, the Chinese and Russians and so forth and their ancillary operations in Africa and elsewhere are highly polluting, highly destructive to the environment. But we're talking other than carbon dioxide. I brought out the carbon dioxide thing just because it shows that a gas that is natural in the atmosphere and is absolutely essential for all life on Earth and commands all this attention. The United States emissions of carbon dioxide are going down because we're switching to natural gas, but the emissions in other countries are skyrocketing. The key point here, though, is the pollution that is real pollution and the amount of mining and development and mineral processing that takes place is happening in other countries without any of the kinds of environmental, labor, safety, reclamation, and other safeguards that American and Western companies have to follow. The Chinese and Russian and African countries and companies, I mean, that are operating under Russian and Chinese auspices don't have any of those rules. They have slave and child labor. They have environmental destruction. Their workplace hazards are incredible. People die in large numbers because of the lack of any safety and environmental and pollution standards there. So we're dealing with a monumental problem that, again, the left, the fascist side of this whole operation here in the United States is refusing to have a discussion about any of this stuff.
Yeah, in fact, there was a recent study, and it was a study by a UN agency, and that big, I don't know, Texas-sized area in the Pacific Ocean where all this plastic and all this stuff is floating around that they're complaining about and blaming on the United States. It turns out that 85% of that is from China and Southeast Asia, and it includes things like fishing nets as well as all the garbage that they're dumping into the oceans, and only about 15% of it come from the Western Hemisphere, and that includes South America and Canada and Mexico and all of them. So that gives you a pretty good idea of how they're skewing the perceptions of pollution to try to attack the United States because we're a free capitalist country and they hate capitalism.
Yeah, and that brings up two points. Number one, even the people that were running the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change have said repeatedly in recent years that this effort of theirs has little or nothing to do with protecting the environment or even fixing or protecting or stabilizing Earth's climate, which has never been stable. It has everything to do, they've said, with number one, replacing capitalism with global control of all economic activity worldwide, and two, redistributing the world's wealth. That's what this is all about, and we need to keep that in mind. Secondly, on your trash point, there's no way this area in the Pacific is the size of Texas, certainly not in the context of a massive pile of trash. There's trash scattered in a variety of places around the Pacific and elsewhere, but it does, as you said, come from Southeast Asia and not from the United States. Here's another interesting thing to me. While these guys are running around and screaming that we have to ban plastic straws, the International Renewable Energy Agency has put out some numbers, and they're saying that disposing of just the worn-out solar panels that the United Nations wants erected around the world by 2050, 30 years from now, under the Paris Climate Treaty's solar energy goals, just disposing of those worn-out solar panels could result in 2 times the tonnage of total plastic waste from the United States last year. 2 times
wow.
the tonnage of U.S. plastic waste just from solar panels that have to be tossed out because they stop working or they get damaged and destroyed. So anything they say on this essentially is a completely phony. And again, that's why they don't want any discussions or debates about any of this, because they don't have the facts to back up anything they're saying.
You know, we talked about having a debate at one of the universities, and I actually suggested that it be at Montana State University, bring Steve Running, one of the co-recipients of the Nobel Prize with Al Gore, over to debate with people like yourself, maybe Lord Monckton, a few other people on climate change, and I would just love to see something like that happen and the international press cover it, but I guarantee you there is no way they will do that.
Well, and you could even do it in the Montana legislature, set something up, and if they don't want to show up, so be it. Have a few of our guys make some of the points that we would make. For example, let's take a look at biofuels. If right now producing ethanol in the United States takes about 40% of all the corn that's grown in the United States. It's grown on cropland about the size of Iowa, and it displaces about 10% of America's gasoline. In order to grow it and process it, you're using enormous amounts of water and pesticides and fertilizers and even fossil fuels, natural gas, gasoline, and diesel. And the fuel actually drives up food prices, because it's affecting the normal operations of farms. It adversely affects food aid and nutrition in poor countries because of those higher food prices, corn and wheat prices. It damages small engines, and it gets one-third fewer miles per gallon than gasoline gets. So let's say we're going to replace 100% of U.S. gasoline with ethanol. We'd have to plant corn on 360 million acres. That's more than twice the land area of Texas. And that's just replacing the gasoline we're using. And then, because they want to get rid of fossil fuels for everything, we'd have to replace the oil and natural gas that are used as feedstocks for pharmaceuticals and cosmetics and even wind turbine blades and solar panel films, as well as paints and synthetic fibers and fertilizers and plastics for fake fur to get rid of all the fur from wild animals, plastics for cell phones and computers and eyeglasses and car bodies and packaging and you name it, all kinds of plastic products. So if we were going to do all of that, replace all that fossil fuel use, we'd have to plant an area 4 times the size of Texas in corn or canola if you want to get biodiesel. And just think what that would do to land available for crops, food crops, and wildlife. We would wipe them out.
Oh,
and
yeah.
We're not even, and that's just with biofuel. And then you get into solar panels and wind farms and batteries, and you're talking land use impacts that are monumental, highly destructive. You would have solar panels and wind turbines on almost every acre of the lower 48 United States to replace all our electricity, for example, and other fossil fuel uses.
Isn't that amazing? And yet when you talk, those realistic numbers, and those are all provable numbers, and when you talk those realistic numbers, they just totally ignore you and just keep talking the same silly sustainability nonsense without even taking any of the scientific data into account.
Yeah, they just keep screaming, climate crisis, the earth is burning, climate crisis, we need to get rid of fossil fuels. And that's supposed to be the end of the argument.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly what they do. They, rather than frame it as a debate issue and then talking about it rationally, they frame it as an absolute. It's like Al Gore and his, the science is settled, there's no more debate, which is ridiculous because in science, it's always, the idea of scientists is to continually test their thesis to make sure that they really work, they really are valid, and that's how science has been forever.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you look at Al Gore, he's got one of the biggest carbon footprints on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
He's got multiple homes. His home in Tennessee uses two or three times the electricity that a normal home does in the United States. He flies private jets all over to give his lectures to the rest of us. He takes limousines and private SUVs and Hummers wherever he goes. He refuses to take any questions that he doesn't pre-approve after any of his discussions. He refuses to engage in a discussion, an interview with anyone who might challenge any of his claims and beliefs and demands. So he's using more fossil fuels than probably 10 or 20 other Americans, and yet he thinks he's got a right to lecture the rest of us and become a multimillionaire in the process.
Yeah, and in fact,
find it just
reprehensible
and hilarious what that guy can get away with.
Well, it shows the hypocrisy of the whole sustainability debate. And incidentally, I did text you on this, but you're aware that Michael Mann's lawsuit against Tim Ball in Canadian court was thrown out, and the judge ordered Mann to pay all of Dr. Ball's court costs.
And that was an interesting case because the whole case involved Dr. Ball making a smart aleck comment that Michael Mann should be in the state pen instead of Penn State, and Mann sued him up there for that, and Ball said, "You're claiming everything you say is factually correct about climate and temperatures and your hockey stick." Well, I think I'm 100% right in what I said. So, in order to demonstrate that I'm wrong and that I'm lying, you need to provide all the data that you use to come up with your hockey stick and your computer algorithms and so forth, so that I can show that based on the facts I'm right. And Mike Mann dragged that out for 6 years, refused to provide any of that. And I think the Canadian courts finally got sick and tired of this. But Mike Mann still has a case going on down here against Mark Stein and National Review and some other folks for claiming that his science is junk science and a lot of data manipulation and stuff. I think that should go the same direction. They need to require that Mike Mann provide all the data and all the algorithms and all the various proxies that he used to concoct these climate temperature claims that I don't think hold water. So here's just one point on that. The computer models, like what Mike Mann have concocted, are showing temperatures that right now, 2019, are supposed to be 9/10 of a degree, almost a full degree Fahrenheit, higher than they actually are, higher than actually measured by satellites and weather balloons. So right now they're a complete degree out of whack with reality. And Mike Mann and his whole cadre of climate alarmist scientists refuse to provide the kind of data that we need to look at to see whether they've been manipulating the data, concocting these crazy computer models that bear no resemblance to reality, whether it's temperatures or hurricanes or tornadoes or other extreme weather events and floods and droughts. The predictions are completely out of whack with what we're seeing in the real world. And that's the key thing here in terms of all this climate change nonsense that's being used to justify demands that we get rid of our fossil fuels. If the data is being manipulated or they're doing all kinds of little tricks to make it look like temperatures are rising really rapidly when in fact they're not, or the hurricanes are increasing in number and intensity when they're not, same for tornadoes. We need to know this, and they don't have a right to hide that data and claim this is proprietary. All this stuff is being paid for by our tax money, and it's being used to justify trashing our economy, our jobs, and our living standards. So I think we have a right to see everything they've collected, everything they've done, how they're playing around with the data. And the courts need to step back and take a hard look at the way they are defrauding us in so many ways. If we don't get that, we're likely to impose policies and laws and regulations and restrictions that are destructive of our living standards and our livelihoods based on completely junk science. I don't think that should happen.
No, it shouldn't. And, the fact is that one of the things that is part of UN Agenda 21 that people don't really want to deal with. In fact, they gloss over it and try to pretend that it doesn't exist. But it's been repeated in their writings a number of times, and that is that they think the ultimate world's sustainable human population is something less than a billion people. And, people say, well, why would they want to destroy our food supply? Why would they want to reduce our environment, our ability to thrive as a country and as a world? And why would they want to reduce all the modern inventions that make life so much better and so much easier? And the bottom line, they want to get rid of people. Isn't that really the truth, Paul?
Well, it absolutely has been a tenet of the environmentalist movement since the 60s with Paul Ehrlich and his population bomb, and John Holdren and a lot of other people believe that, and my view is them first, control their own populations first, take a cyanide capsule, whatever the heck you want to do, but don't tell the rest of us how we need to live our lives, especially when so much of this seems to be based on data manipulation and all kinds of other crazy claims that have no basis in reality, and on computer models that have never been verified against actual data. The models are completely out of whack, and as I suggested, it appears that, and certainly a lot of scientists have questioned the data and algorithms and methodologies being employed by these various climate scientists to come up with these assertions that we face a man-made climate crisis, when what they're talking about just isn't happening out there. Let me just give you one example, which is the hurricanes. We've had far fewer hurricanes in the last half century than we did in the previous half century, and we actually went from October of 2005 until August of 2017, almost 12 years without a single Category 3 to 5 hurricane hitting the U.S. mainland. That had never happened before. Previous record was 9 years without such a hurricane, and that record was set in the 1860s. And if you look at tornadoes, same thing. We had far more violent F4, F5 tornadoes back in the stretch from 1950 to 1984 than we did over the next 34 years. And last year, 2018, we didn't have one single violent tornado touching down anywhere in the United States. That's the first time in recorded history that ever happened. Those are two of the most fundamental claims of the environmentalist and climate alarm crowd, and about increasing numbers and intensity of hurricanes and tornadoes, and they're both completely false. But I would add, too, if carbon dioxide is causing climate change and extreme weather, then we have to thank carbon dioxide for reducing the number of hurricanes and tornadoes hitting the United States, it seems to me. That's only logical. But they won't buy
into that. Yeah, that's absolutely right. But they don't want to talk about that, do they?
No, absolutely not.
Well, I'd love to, you know, your book, Eco-Imperialism, to me, I mean, that was a breath of fresh air in a world of the goofy sustainability movement talking about how they're going to save the world and they're going to make life so much better for all these poor people around the world. All they want to do is take our wealth and hand it over to other countries and at the same time reduce their ability to develop their own economic base and their own ability to crawl out from under the Stone Age. And the reality is what the environmental movement is doing is really the exact opposite of what these countries need. That's what your book really was about. Tell our listeners a little bit more about your book and about some of the ideas that the environmental movement is promoting in areas like Africa and underdeveloped countries all over the world.
Yeah, my book is titled Eco-Imperialism, Green Power, Black Death. And the fundamental point is that environmental laws and regulations that made sense at some level in the United States and Europe and Canada and so forth to get rid of some of the pollution problems we had 40, 50 years ago that were becoming quite significant, made a lot of sense here. But then the environmental movement, having won those battles, and I was part of that environmental movement. I was an Earth Day organizer for the very first Earth Day on my college campus back in 1970. The environmental movement went from really legitimate issues to a bunch of phony issues and becoming more and more wealthy and intolerant and aggressive and demanding all across the board when it came to developing countries in Africa and Asia and so forth. They came in and imposed their intolerant views and their phony environmental analyses on these countries and basically said, you can't use pesticides to control malaria. You can't use GMO biotech corn and other crops. You can't use modern farming methods, even hybrid seeds and tractors and fertilizers. And above all, you can't use fossil fuels or nuclear, and they don't want them to use hydroelectric either. They basically are telling them, you have to use wind turbines and a few solar panels, a little solar panel on your hut to operate a light bulb and a little 1 cubic foot refrigerator. And that's gonna improve your lives, but only a little bit, only at the margins, and only to the extent that a few wind turbines and solar panels will enable you to improve your living standards and health and maybe extend your life from 40 years on average to 42 years. Those countries, as I look out there, are not about to do that. You see China alone, it's this year's coal-based electricity generation, just what they put online in 2019, will be more coal-fired electricity generation than the entire United States already has operating. Just what they're adding this year is more than the United States already has. And they're starting to build a lot of natural gas power plants. Sure, they're throwing in some wind turbines and solar panels in places where they're doing it for public relations purposes, greenwashing, I would say, or to reach, get some electricity to some of their more remote villages that aren't yet connected to the grid. But India's in the same situation. Around the world, there's well over a billion people that never have electricity, and up around 3 billion people that only have it a few hours a week at totally unpredictable times, grossly insufficient to provide any kind of any semblance of a modern lifestyle and living standards. And people are dying literally by the millions. People are burning wood and animal dung and grass in their homes to heat and cook with. And especially the little kids are getting lung diseases and dying in large numbers, and so are the mothers because they're the ones breathing this stuff all the time. Millions more die from lung and from intestinal diseases that are due to unsafe drinking water and spoiled food. And those are all diseases of poverty and energy deprivation that's being forced on these countries and these families by the global environmentalist movement. I'm still an environmentalist and a conservationist, and I believe in real sustainability, but not this phony stuff that we're seeing across the board, and not in a kind of environmentalism that refuses to have a discussion about any of these issues.
Well, Paul, you're right, and I'm in the same position that you are. I always considered myself a strong environmentalist, but it's from the conservationist really side of the equation, and it's understanding, you know, that there are some things we needed to improve on. There were some things we needed to reduce, like the amount of sulfur dioxide. The levels of pollution that were really impacting our environment, and not carbon dioxide, but the real pollution. And so we've always promoted just wise use of our natural resources. And part of the capitalist approach to the world is always improving everything to make it fit an ideal situation where you use less resources and you achieve more. Isn't that really the heart of the capitalist movement?
Yeah, absolutely. And whether it's motivated by profits or just a feeling that you could do better, make a better whatever it is, or use fewer raw materials in doing it, less water, I think that's an incremental improvement that we see over and over. Just take a look at beverage cans. They used to be steel cans for beers and sodas, and then they went to aluminum, and over a period of time, the extrusion of aluminum in the new can-making process dramatically reduced the amount of aluminum that's used to make a single beverage can. They dropped the amount of aluminum by over 50% over a period of years, and then they began recycling all these cans. So those are real sustainability initiatives. There are printing processes that use fewer hydrocarbons or no hydrocarbons and end up with an ink that can be reprocessed. All kinds of things that reduce water usage. Israel has been a leader in the world in recapturing and reusing water and using far less water in agriculture to produce same amount of crops. You go to the Arava Valley area of Israel, for example, and drip irrigation is allowing them to grow crops in a desert area that gets one-tenth of the rain that we get in New Mexico and Arizona on an annual basis. And yet they're growing crops there in amazing numbers, tomatoes and squashes and figs and dates and bananas, all sorts of things. It's a matter of using what I call, what Julian Simon called, the ultimate resource, that gray matter between our ears, to be innovative and think these things through and come up with solutions to the problems we face. And if those solutions create some more problems, different problems, then we solve those problems as well. But that's same ultimate resource and innovation and thinking needs to go into this demand that we get rid of fossil fuels and replace those fossil fuels with wind and solar power that would be monumentally destructive of our United States and global environment.
Well, you know, you mentioned Israel, and I know they're also a leader in desalinization processes that are actually economical. And, you know, they keep talking about how we don't have enough water to be sustainable. And, in fact, you know, most of the planet's covered in water. It just has high salinity. And the reality is that we, you know, we can do just about anything we want to do if we just use a little of our capability intellectually. And we're such innovators. We need to use more of the innovative side of capitalism and less of that collectivist side of doing absolutely nothing that improves life in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And Israel is exporting its desalination and drip irrigation technologies all around the world. 100%, virtually 100% of all Israel's drinking water comes from desalination plants. A half dozen plants on the Red Sea, Gulf of Aqaba down in the south, and along the Mediterranean, using Mediterranean seawater. They're doing all sorts of other things, recycling nearly 100% of all the household dish and toilet water and bathing water goes back into reprocessing so that it can be used for agriculture and other purposes. They're very careful and very efficient in how they utilize those resources. Lessons for all of us, I think. I go down to our southwest of Phoenix sometimes, and here in the middle of the day, they're watering their lawn with fine mist sprays that lose about a third to half of the water before it soaks in and nourishes the plants. There's just a lot of wastage here, and that's where sustainability should come from, not this nonsense that we should get rid of fossil fuels and replace them with literally millions of wind turbines and hundreds of millions of solar panels around the United States. That's what it would take to replace our 3.9 billion megawatts of electricity that we use every year to power this economy, this civilization we have. People just have no clue how many millions of solar panels and wind turbines we're talking about, and a billion batteries to back up that power for just 7 windless days. We can go into that in a little bit if you want. But
yeah,
enormous numbers, and then the metals and concrete required to build and install all of those things and more transmission lines. It's phenomenal.
Yes, it really is. And free markets, capitalism, I think free markets are the key to making us that much better and that much more technologically sustainability based, because as you say, you know, they irrigate with this fine mist of water in dry areas. Well, make the price be the determination of how much they want to waste. You know, the reality is if economically, if you can't afford it, then you're going to do something different. And that's the way free markets really work, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. And you look at these countries that Bernie Sanders and this entire Democratic presidential field and all these climate campaigners and climate crazies and renewable energy advocates are talking about and extolling for their supposed virtues. Those countries are not doing well by their environment at all. Just take a look at the metals, that the rare earths and lithium and cobalt and other metals that go into making wind turbines, solar panels, and batteries, the kind in your computers or in your Tesla cars, the kind of batteries that would be used for backup power if you get rid of coal and gas-fired backup power plants for wind and solar. Those metals come from a couple of places in particular, Baotou, Inner Mongolia, where it's basically slave labor with no, I mean, they're getting paid, but very low wages that in no way reflect the horrible conditions, no safety or pollution controls in their mines or factories, massive toxic wasteland that goes for miles and miles all around that mining area there, inside the processing plants. No masks on people, just foul, disgusting air, people dying. You go to Democratic Republic of Congo, where the cobalt comes from computer and other batteries and your Teslas and so forth, and it's slave and child labor. Kids as young as 4 years old, 40,000 of them mining that cobalt, children, 40,000 children, and then their mothers and fathers down in these filthy, toxic, radioactive mine pits, crawling around in tiny tunnels, which is why they want to have these little four-year-olds, because they can go in these teeny tiny tunnels that cave in from time to time, and they're exposing their bodies to all these toxics 24/7. This is where our batteries come from, slave and child labor. Do the environmentalists, do any of the presidential candidates on the Democratic side want to talk about this? Absolutely not.
Yeah, no, they don't, because the reality is it destroys their socialist controlled economy paradigm, because most of the countries where these excesses are happening, where this child labor and things like that are happening, are countries that are socialist and communist.
Well, either that or, you know, essentially
totalitarian.
I think China, totalitarian. Yeah. I think China's moving from communist, where the state owns all the companies, to a sort of a fascist economy where the state just tells the companies what they can do. And that's absolutely contrary to anything I would want or believe in. So we got to go a different route on this, and we've got to end this totalitarian, fascist, anti-discussion, anti-debate approach that we're having jammed down our throats, where the people on the climate alarmist side are combining their own thought control processes on the campuses with Google and Facebook and YouTube and our universities and mainstream media to censor and marginalize and ostracize and shadow ban and electronic book burn, all kinds of contrarian, alternative, differing evidence and perspectives. And they basically want to take us into a very totalitarian system of government, with them in charge, of course, and telling all the rest of us what we can buy, what we can sell, what we can drive, how far we can drive, whether we can even get in an airplane and take a vacation somewhere, and what we can think and say and do, what kind of living standards we're going to be allowed to have. This is where this is going.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they're going to assume and demand that they be exempted from all these rules that they impose on the rest of us, because they will be the governing and ruling classes and therefore should have special privileges that they already demand. It's a scary thought.
It is. And you know, the reality of the control society, we've already got it in Washington, D.C., because Congress, for the most part, is exempted from the rules that they pass for the rest of us. And, you know, they seem to have a double standard on what is lawful and legal and what we're supposed to live with, because if you don't believe that, take a look at what's been happening, you know, in our country with people like Hillary Clinton, who can do very unlawful, illegal things, like her servers and all the Spygate stuff that happened as a result of her incompetence, really. And almost, I think it goes beyond incompetence. I think she just has such a haughty attitude about everything the Clintons do, they should be able to get away with, and it shouldn't be a problem. This thing that came up with Epstein and the fact that they had another Arkansite in prison. Gee, I wonder if that had anything to do with Bill Clinton, you know, and the fact that he was on his Lolita Express documented at least 17 times. This is a sort of double standard we have in our country by the ruling class over us, and that's exactly what you're talking about, only under a system of government that is really a totally control grid government.
Yeah, we've got to distinguish between what I think is really downright illegal and criminal activity by the Clintons and the deep state and the people that were trying to get Donald Trump and are still trying to get him, versus normal exemptions by Congress from laws that they pass for everybody else. The health care system, for example, Obamacare, they set aside a separate type of health care system for members of Congress and their staffs. This is what they do all the time. They would do the same thing if it comes to electrical power. They don't want to have to live with electricity when it's available instead of when they need it. So they will have power plants that work for them while they demand that the rest of us live under a different kind of electrification system. You know, I grew up 8 miles from the first house in the world that was powered by hydroelectric. And my grandmother always used to tell me, the only good thing about the good old days is that they're gone. So those two facts have stuck with me for a long time. Innovation and creativity and capitalist approaches to things. Even if you don't want to use the word capitalist, use the term free enterprise innovation. Working with what actually works, and improving our living standards, our health, our longevity. You go back to 1900 and the average American was living to about 47, and now the average American lives into mid to late 70s with far better health and access to technologies that, my goodness, we could never even imagine even 25 years ago. And again, yeah, tremendous amount of downsizing and miniaturization, so they use less electricity and fewer raw materials than they used to. All these people that are screaming in the streets to stop climate change are using their computers and their cars and going all over the place by air and other means of transportation that require fossil fuels and electricity. But they're demanding that we get rid of that stuff. they don't think very far, and they're not required to by our educational system, by the professors and teachers in our educational system. They're excused. They're incredibly arrogant, intolerant, and pampered, privileged, self-important, and abusive to anyone who doesn't feel and think and believe the way they do. And God forbid that facts should get in the way of any of this.
Right.
And they're egged on by their professors and their teachers and by law enforcement and so forth. They're allowed to get away with all this stuff, all this abusive behavior. Just yesterday here in the Washington, D.C. area, they were blocking roads and highways all day long, and the police would give them three warnings, but the three warnings were over a period of 2 or 3 hours, so they could shut down an entire intersection right in the middle of downtown Washington for hours on end and stymie block all the transportation. The amount of gasoline that was wasted yesterday and the amount of greenhouse gas emissions, nitrous oxide and ozone and stuff that was coming out of those cars while they were idling there was pretty monumental. And do these kids think about any of that? Absolutely not. But they're given the right, quote-unquote, the right to skip classes so they can join in these protests and inconvenience people's lives all around Washington. I guess the good thing is, being Washington, it was probably mostly deep state Democrats and deep state liberals, deep state members of Congress that were inconvenienced and sitting in that traffic, as well as a lot of lobbyists. So maybe that's all a good thing.
Well, and I lived out in D.C. for a couple of years when I was in the service, and I have to tell you, any excuse to not have to go to work, they're all for it. Anyway, Paul, I want to get back to your discussion about how the environmental movement, how badly they are polluting and destroying our environment with some of their crazy ideas. And we've got a little time here to do that. I'd like to have you kind of amplify on the problem with the environmental movement's claim that they are improving the environment when in fact they're destroying much of the environment with the crazy technology that they're promoting.
Yeah, let me go through a couple of those things because I think that's really important. So I'm going to look at solar panels and wind energy and batteries and just throw out a number of very interesting points. Be better to be able to show everybody some sort of a slide to lay these things out, but I'll try to keep the numbers simple and memorable. So if you take solar, right now there's a big solar farm on Nevada's Nellis Air Force Base. It puts out 15 megawatts of electricity, but it only does it about 40% of the year. And it has 72,000 panels, solar panels, on 140 acres. So state away, Arizona, near Phoenix, there's the Palo Verde Nuclear Power Plant, and it generates, from less land, 760 times more electricity than the Nellis Air Force Base solar panels do, and they do it 90 to 95% of the time instead of 40% of the time. And if you were going to use if you're going to use Nellis's solar technology to generate Palo Verde's electricity output, you'd need solar panels completely blanketing an area 10 times larger than Washington, D.C. But you would still get electricity only about 30 or 40% of the year. So you can't possibly do that sort of thing. Let's look at wind energy for a minute. The United States uses almost 4 billion megawatt hours every year to power our economy, our hospitals, our schools, our factories, our internet, and all the other things that use electricity. And if we were to use wind turbines to replace all that electricity and then also get rid of all the coal and gas-fired backup power plants and the natural gas we use for home heating and the coal and natural gas that power our factories, get rid of gasoline-powered vehicles and replace them all with wind-generated electricity. And then, because we don't want to have any gas and coal-fired power plants, we would also use wind turbines to generate enough extra electricity every windy day to charge batteries up so that we would have backup electricity from batteries for 7 straight windless days. So how many, and the other important thing is when you start building and installing that many wind turbines, you can't assume they're going to be generating electricity about 30% of the year, which is roughly what they get in a decent wind area. You're only going to get electricity about 15% of the year. So 15% of your daily hours are going to actually have electricity generation, and the rest of the time there's not going to be any electricity, so you're going to need backup energy. So right now, we've got about 58,000 wind turbines in the United States. If we're going to get rid of all that coal and gas-fired electricity and all that gasoline and stuff for our vehicles and so forth in our factories, we would need almost 14 million wind turbines, 1.8 Wow. megawatt generation for each one of them. And if you're going to have, which you need at least 50 acres of open space for every turbine to give enough room for the wind to blow around and turn the turbine blades, you would need to have 700 million acres covered with wind turbines. That's 10 times the land area of Arizona. So
that's amazing.
14
that really
million
is.
Wind turbines. And then get into manufacturing those wind turbines, and you would need something like 4 billion tons of steel and copper and alloys just for the turbines and the towers, and another 8 billion tons of steel and concrete for the foundations that are buried in the ground and hold up those wind turbines. And then you'd need 4 million tons of rare earth metals. Again, those all come from China, from Baotou, with its horrendous environmental conditions over there, to have motors and magnets and other components. And crazy enough, you'd need 1 billion tons of petroleum-based special composites for the turbine blades. So all of those materials have to be mined and processed and smelted and manufactured somewhere. It probably won't happen in the United States because we would be shutting down whatever we have left of that. And that would mean we'd have to remove hundreds of billions of tons of earth and rock overburden just to get to the ores and process tens of billions of tons of ore to get those metals. So we're talking about massive environmental impacts mm-hmm. from the mining and the processing and the installation of all these things. And then if you want to have batteries, how many batteries are you going to need to back up all that electricity that we need for just 7 straight windless days? Be about about a billion of these batteries of the kind that are in a Tesla. Based
wow.
on cobalt that comes from child labor in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And so then you have to add in all the extra mining and processing for the metals that go into those batteries. And I haven't even talked about the transmission lines that would have to connect all of these thousands of miles of new transmission lines. And again, this is just for the United States, just United States electricity generation. Do this on a global scale. And I don't know, you're talking maybe 50 million wind turbines, maybe 100 million.
Yeah,
probably. And think of the mining. How many more mines, open pit and other kinds of mines, would we have to establish to get all those raw materials? Do any of these Democrats that are running for president or any of the university professors or the students or any of the media talk about any of this or allow anyone to talk about any of this? Is this the kind of environmental future we really want?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Paul, I have to tell you that they understand really some of, not all of them, obviously. As V.I. Lennon referred to useful idiots, there are a number of people that, you know, they just mouth things because they don't have enough common sense to really look at them. But an awful lot of these people really do understand what they're doing, and literally what they want to do is to shut down capitalism in the United States of America and turn us into a third world country, turn us into a third world economy. They hate the fact that we've been prosperous, that we have a market-driven economy, and they want to make sure that they end that. Average Americans need to wake up and realize these people are really deadly serious about turning the United States of America into a third world country, because that's their vision of a controllable, sustainable world.
Yeah, for everybody except them. I don't know if you've seen The Hunger Games, but a whole lot of young people have, and so have a whole lot of us adults.
Yeah, I sure have.
I found it fascinating. And here you've got the capital, which lives very well and high on the hog indeed, while out in the provinces, people live by hand and mouth, basically, very impoverished existences. And this is kind of what they've got in mind. They're special. They're privileged. They're elites. They have more wisdom than the rest of us, and they should be able to tell everybody how to live while they themselves don't have to abide by any of those rules, whether it's the amount of beef they can eat or the air travel they can enjoy, or car driving, or air conditioning. Air conditioning would have to be a thing of the past, but I'd love to have members of Congress living and members of the deep state bureaucracy here in the Washington, D.C. area with our humid, hot, disgusting summers live without air conditioning. My solution for a lot of these folks is only they should have no air conditioning. The rest of us should have air conditioning. Force them not to have it. It would cut down on the number of hours they would want to spend legislating and regulating the rest of our lives.
Boy, that's the truth. And I, like I say, I lived out there for a couple of years. I know exactly what you're talking about. Their summers are so humid and so hot, it just blisters you. And I'd love to see Congress have to abide by a no air conditioning rule. I think that would be a great way to limit the amount of new regulations and legislation that they pass.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, their whole theme for whether they've been successful each year is based on how many new laws and regulations they can write and impose on the rest of us. Mm-hmm. It's crazy. We don't need more laws and regulations. We need a lot fewer of them.
Well, and that's kind of a common condition, and I see that at the state level. I really even see it at local government levels. It's like people think that because they're elected to office, somehow they have to produce some legislation. They have to produce some new laws. And in fact, what they ought to do is strike about 90% of the existing laws off the books, so that because many of them go back over 100 years, and it's time that we have fewer regulations and fewer laws that make no sense for this country.
Yeah, absolutely. Clearly, some laws are necessary just to govern human conduct and prevent bad things from bad people from harming the rest of us. But the question becomes, at what point do the laws themselves cause more harm than they're preventing? And I think President Trump has made it pretty clear that we can roll back a lot of those laws and regulations and have an economy that thrives, creates jobs for blacks, whites, Hispanics, and everybody, does not worsen our pollution anywhere, but gets the stock market going to record heights, employment going to record levels for everybody, living standards and wages going up. And I haven't seen anything happen that's harming our environment, our health, our living standards, or our climate. So, yes, let's have the laws and rules that we absolutely need, but we don't need a full-time legislature and bureaucracy and the numbering in the millions in order to govern our lives. I think people can, for the most part, be pretty responsible citizens, especially if they understand that that responsibility is something that we expect of them, and that they're not going to be bailed out at every turn if they fail to be responsible.
Right. That's one of the things that they're promoting. The same people are promoting socialism and communism and technocracy and all the other garbage that's going to really destroy our free market economy and our free market system. These very same people are the ones that are promoting all these controls over people that make them less responsible, make them less accountable for their own actions, and that's a bit of a problem.
Yeah, it absolutely is. It's really hurt the whole country, and I think the other aspect of this is that the legislators and regulators can never be held accountable for the damage they cause, and the phony studies that they produce, the harm that they inflict on the rest of us. I think that should change. There should be penalties that we can mete out to those people. Voting them out of office is one thing, but you can't even vote out the deep state bureaucrats. So
right.
We've got to find a solution to some of these endemic problems.
Yeah, they have to be accountable. There's no question about that. Well, Paul, I have to tell you, your name has come up. I'm involved as the executive director of the Red Pill Expo, and your name has come up as someone that we would really like to bring in next summer at our Red Pill Expo we're going to be doing next year. We've talked about doing a climate debate as kind of the centerpiece of a program at the Red Pill Expo, and trying to get people to come up from the other side to debate the issues is going to be very interesting. That's the one thing that's kind of held us back from promoting doing a program like this even more, is the fact that the other side doesn't want an open and fair debate, because they'll lose every time. So we're trying to work on that and figure out a way we can do that, that we can get representation from the other side so that you can beat the holy crap out of them in an honest and open and fair debate. We've got a number of people like yourself that would be perfect for that role. So keep in touch with me and keep posted on that, because I believe that that's in the cards for next summer at our Red Pill event we do next year, as a expose of the climate fraud and what sustainability really means. So keep that on your dance card, Paul. I'd like to give you just a couple of minutes. We're kind of at the end of our time here, but I'd like to give you a couple of minutes to really talk about promoting some of the groups you work with, and then also how our listeners can read your books and get in touch with you, how they can get more information on a regular basis from your website.
Sure. Thanks for that opportunity, Dan. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate the opportunity to just be with you here this morning. I work with the Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow, which is known as CFACT, CFACT.org, and you can find a lot of my articles right there on their website, as well as on townhall.com under columnists. I work with the Heartland Institute, with the Congress of Racial Equality, and some other think tanks, generally promoting energy, environmental, human rights, better living standards for people all around the world. And I do a lot of books and articles, mostly focused on articles and reports these days, sustainability and climate change and such things. Again, my main book is Eco-Imperialism, Green Power, Black Death. You can find a lot of those books and e-books on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. Heartland.org is another website for the Heartland Institute. That'll give people good access to the things that I try to ponder and talk about on a regular basis.
Well, I know that, too, you co-authored a book with Ron Arnold that just came out, I guess it was about a year ago or maybe even a little bit less, that really points out the fraud, the money machine of the environmental movement. Maybe tell our listeners a little about that book.
Yeah, that does get into the where the money comes from and where the power is and the kinds of fraud that's perpetrated on our on people around the world as a result of these environmentalist policies. And the green machine, the green money machine, is something we all need to be aware of and be ready to take them on. If anybody wants to go beyond some of that and get into climate issues, I think Mark Morano's book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Climate Change, is a really good, easy read, covers every aspect of the climate, man-made climate crisis fraud, gives a lot of facts, again, that the other side just doesn't want to hear, doesn't want other people to know about. So those are just a couple good places to go. And another place that publishes a lot of my stuff that is just a superb place to go if you want the facts on climate and energy is whatsupwiththat.com. And it's W-A-T-T-S, like the unit of energy, whatsupwiththat.com. A lot of good scientific discussion, but generally in really easy-to-understand terminology. And most visited climate website, along with climatedepot.com.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you, it's always a pleasure, Paul, to have you on because you're such a wealth of knowledge and such a gentleman about the other side. I tend to get a little bit. Worked up about some of the things that they come up with, but I really think that the key to the discussion and to really getting this country turned around is somehow we need to open that public debate and get the issues of climate before the American people. And I'm hoping that somehow we can do that. I'm going to work on that. I'm going to do the best I can. I know you've been trying to do that. It's time that the American people see all the facts, not just the few, and they aren't really facts, but a few of the so-called truths from the environmental movement. And it's time that we see the bigger picture.
Absolutely. And I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you this morning to reach many, many people out there to do exactly that. Thanks so much.
Well, Paul, thank you again. And I want our listeners to certainly tune in next week for another opportunity to help connect the dots. I'm sorry that Caleb didn't get a chance to join us, but maybe we can do this program again in the very near future and we can get Caleb on with you because I know you said you make a splendid tag team together.
Oh, we do, but he can hold his own just fine, too. So keep talking to him and get him on alone. He'll cover a whole lot of territory that I haven't. And do keep me in mind for Red Pill next summer. I'll see if I can work that into my crazy schedule here and join you at least for a couple more radio shows. It'll be a lot of fun.
Wonderful. Well, I look forward to that, and I hope you can we can get together this winter down in the Tucson area. I know that you occasionally get down to that area. I want you to for sure stay in touch with me on when you're going to be down there. Maybe we can get together for lunch or something.
That would be just great. I've got relatives in Tucson. My wife grew up in Phoenix, so she's got relatives there. So, yeah, well, hope to be back that way. Thanks so much.
Okay. Well, that sounds good. And again, folks, join us next week, and we will help you to connect the dots. Thank you, and good day.
It was 1776 when the founders signed the writ of independence from the Brits. It was revolution. Now an enemy from within would enslave us all again and deprive us of our rights in the Constitution. Restore the Republic. Wake up, it's time to unbind.